Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Hello and welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have you back again and also lovely to have my two co-hosts, Kate and Dave. Kate, how are you today?
Great to see you, Pete. I think today is going to be super busy for us, me and Dave. We're recording this on the first day of Melbourne reopening and phones started going bananas and agents started reshuffling everything and putting a solid auction date on everything that's coming up. So, yes, it's exciting and it's super busy.
Yeah, coincidentally, today's also the first day South Australians come out of lockdown.
Yeah.
And I know there's already open inspections scheduled for this evening. So it's back to business as usual. Dave, how are you going?
I'm very well, Pete. My wife and I and lots of other parents around here have been high-fiving and breathing a deep sigh of relief.
Yeah.
Homeschooling over again.
Yeah. Interesting. I was saying to Kate before we started recording that for the first time ever, the South Australian school students, in particular high school students and uni students, have to wear masks on campus, whereas you've been doing that for a long time.
That's right. It's a bit of a novelty for you guys. My daughter was not happy about having to get up early and don the school uniform. She's managed to squeeze, you know, 2.5 weeks into wearing one of those big, disgusting, fluffy hoodies. Have you seen those advertised on Instagram? Those big Yeti outfits, they're foul.
Yeah.
My 7-year-old wasn't too keen either for his first day back in a while, but he worked his way into it.
Back to work.
Putting
back
on the uniform.
Yeah.
Back to the real world. All right. Yeah. Talking about back to the real world, let's start with a market update before we get into our topic for today, which is the population pyramid. Kate, what's your market update for the day?
Well, my market update, I say this with a sigh as well. We had NAB release some predictions, I might call them. They've readjusted their forecasts for capital growth for the major cities. And like I imagined, the phone started ringing and people wanted to chat to me because NAB have decided that Melbourne's perhaps going to do well next year. It just goes to show, you know, how we need to question data, because this is a bank that, if we look at previous forecasts, they've been ratcheting it up and quite significantly as well. And back when we were talking about double-digit growth, this particular banking economist was talking about things being much tougher. So I think consumers need to put irrelevant weighting on information they get, but they also have to retrospectively look back and question just, you know, what's changing things and what the delays are.
Yeah, very interesting. So that got the headlines because it was something extraordinary and now everybody's talking about it. Dave?
Yeah, look, that was going to be my market update as well. So, you know, NAB with their delayed forecast, once the horse has already bolted, that essentially the property market will grow this year by about 19% across Australia. Now they've made predictions for Sydney of 21.6, Melbourne 17.6, Brisbane 19.5, Perth, the most sluggish, at 11.6, Hobart 23.5, Adelaide 17.4. But look, we're already 7 months into the year. As we've been talking about over the last 1 or 2 months and we've done internally at Property Planning Australia, if you remove the negative months of last year, you can already see that it's on track to hit these numbers. It doesn't take rocket science to make these predictions. Now, mind you, this is their third prediction for 2021 as well. So, you know, it's gone from initially 8%, then 14%, and now they're up around where it's actually likely to finish up, 19%. So just echoing Kate's thoughts, if you're not a specialist in the specific market, you tend to lag, and we're seeing that consistently across the macro sort of banks and investment company economists.
I think you made a really good point, Dave, and in reference to rolling average, that was what you were hinting at when we as the rolling average keeps moving on, rolling down the hill, we're getting rid of our disastrous months from last year. And it's shaping up very, very quickly. Now, it doesn't, as you said, it doesn't take a rocket science. I don't even think it takes much of a statistician to work that out. So it will be interesting to see what comes out of NAB and other economists who are tipping forecasting figures as Sydney continues to be gripped by this as well.
So my market update, I heard a collective sigh of relief on Monday when the Labor Party announced that they weren't going to be taking changes to negative gearing and capital gains tax to the next election. And as the chairperson of the Property Investment Professionals of Australia, who's been working hard for those changes not to be made, that's very pleasing. Because, I mean, the headlines say, you know, we're giving rich people tax breaks. The reality is more than 90% of property investors only own one or two properties. So these are what we typically call mum and dad investors. Not rich people driving Lamborghinis and Porsches, but your typical mum and dad investor who's looking to better the retirement. And our investor surveys, which we do annually, consistently show that the main reason people invest in property is for their retirement.
For all you budding property planners out there, at Property Planning Australia, we are looking to hire a new property planner. So if you live in Melbourne, have a passion for helping people make educated and superior property, mortgage and money management decisions, we would love to hear from you if you have at least 5 years of experience working as a fully qualified financial planner. If that sounds like you, please send us a copy of your CV to info@propertyplanning.com.au. You can also give us a call if you like on 1300 896 045.
Talking about retirement, today's topic is the population pyramid, but before we start, because we are going to be talking a lot about baby boomers and the ageing population. So before the young ones switch off, you think that this might not be relevant to you, I strongly encourage you to watch an episode of Catalyst, which I saw last night, on retirement. And the reason I say that, even though there was lots of older people on there was a 29-year-old girl who was planning to retire at the age of 35. And she's using a strategy called FIRE, which I think Kate has used before, F-I-R-E, which stands for Financial Independence, Retire Early. So the FIRE movement, basically it's about saving most of your money, saving and investing most of your money. And this particular girl was saving 75% of her income and her partner's income. And she started, must have started to do that in their early 20s or her early 20s because her partner was a bit older. You know, the younger ones who think retirement's a long way off, yes, it is, but that's traditional thinking for those of us that think we're going to retire at 60, 65 or 70. There are options to retire early, but that means you've got to make some big sacrifices now to do that.
Just on that, I think it's just as important for people to still think what they're going to do beyond their supposed retirement, because you've still got to keep living life and you've still got to have interests and passions, and you know, so you've still got to have a plan, even if you are diligent enough to reach such a goal, such as FIRE.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that, Dave, because one thing that I was going to mention later on is there was the word for the day. It's a Japanese word called ikigaya, which is the reason for getting up in the morning. So once you retire, you got to work out what's your reason for getting up in the morning, because what was brought out in the show, a lot of people's identity was closely related to their job. But if you're not working anymore, then who are you or what are you doing? Whether you're doing it at 65 or 35 doesn't matter. You've got to work that out. Yeah, very good point you raised there, Dave.
Well, just on that, I think ikigai relates to our whole lives. Mm-hmm. And we don't need to wait till we retire, but the challenge is to have that motivation, ikigai, to get out of bed whilst we're working, whilst we're studying, and keep trying to strive for that and understand what it is that provides us with our ikigaya. And that's one of the great challenges for every human being that drives our motivation and sense of purpose and fulfillment.
My meaning of retirement is not working. It's waking up one day when I don't have to work and I don't have to generate an income. I actually have choice, and it might be to keep doing what I do and do it in a more giving way, or to explore the education side of it, or whatever it is. I've got a burning desire not to stop doing what I do, but the idea of not being on a treadmill where I'm generating a household income has a lot of appeal, and a lot of people dream about that. It's just shaking off those shackles one day.
Very good. Well, that's an excellent segue into our topic for today, which is the population pyramid. So just some stats to get us started. Back in 1927, almost 100 years ago, only 5% of the population was aged over 65. 50 years later, 9%. So that was almost double in 50 years. 40 years later, it was 15%. So in 2017, 15% of our population was 65 and over. And predictions are by 2057, it'll be 22%. 2097, it'll be 25%. So within this century, a quarter of us are going to be 65 or over, which has some huge implications for many reasons, in particular government. If 25% of us are not working, generating an income and still need to survive, how's the rest of the population going to help us out with that? So, Kate, the first question to you is, what historical and social factors have contributed to this increasing percentage?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. And certainly social policy and bringing in more people is playing a huge part. But we're living longer. You know, our life expectancy is very different. And war times did impact birth. And we had a period there where there weren't a lot of births, and then there were loads of them. And that gave way to the baby boomer generation. So they're coming through as a real force to be reckoned with. And as I've said earlier, waves of migration activity. We have, you know, certain age groups coming out. We bring in skilled migrants into this country. And it has been in waves, whether it's been for government reasons or whether it's had blocks like COVID preventing the numbers that we've been seeing, that creates a wave. And we've got slower birth rates now compared to decades earlier. If you look at the family unit and the nuclear family size, it's smaller now than what it used to be. Dave, what do you think? There'll be other reasons that you come up with.
Oh, look, I think you've nailed the primary reasons. An ageing population certainly can stagnate an economy, and for a long period of time, and Japan is a great example of that. They've been in essential stagnation for a couple of decades. You know, increased health costs, the increased costs of funding retirement. Thankfully, we've got one of the best retirement funding systems in the world with our superannuation system. But that's feeding through, you know, a lot of the people retiring at the moment didn't have access to superannuation through their whole working lives. So I see here the average household was 4.5 in 1911, and now it's only 2.6 in 2016. So we're having less children. I've got three, so we're contributing.
Well, I've got four, so yeah, certainly.
Yeah, but back when we were kids, you know, our mates at school, if they had two or three or four brothers and sisters, it wasn't a big deal. And nowadays, you know, I say to you, oh, you've got heaps of kids, Dave, because, you know, three is larger than the average. And if someone has, you know, more kids than you can put in a normal sedan, then that's a really huge family. But I went to a Catholic school and we had some families with more than 10 kids.
So that's a good international example you raised there, Dave. Japan has certainly been suffering the effects of an ageing population. China was going that way because they had the one-child policy for a long time, and then recently they changed it to two. Now they lifted it again because they can see that there's going to be a severe issue with their ageing population if they don't have younger people coming through.
What's happening in Italy and Greece, Pete?
Well, the whole Western, I don't know if it's the whole world, but certainly the whole Western world is moving towards having less kids. And this is, and I think you're going to talk about this later on, Kate, and this is one of the main reasons is because rather than in, say, in a nuclear family where the female tended to stay at home and look after kids and look after the older people in more traditional families, now they're going to work. So there's less opportunity to have more kids. Plus, people are looking to spend more money. For you to spend more money, you need to make more money. And probably the best way to do that is for both of you to be working rather than one person to be working. Italy, I think, Kate, Italy is actually going backwards. There's not enough new people being born. No, that's not good. There are more deaths than births. That's what I should be saying.
That was academia. There are more deaths than
They're not replacing themselves. They're not replacing themselves. Yeah.
Well, I've read a few articles about the fact that there's a belief that China won't be able to replace themselves at a fast enough rate, and it's going to put extreme pressure on them to keep up the rate of growth that they've had in their economy and trying to move more of, you know, because one of their key goals is growing the middle class's average income. So that's going to probably have some international ramifications if they start to struggle with continuing to raise the living standards of their population, which could have impacts obviously on Australia as well.
Yeah, so there are many countries around the world facing this ageing population issue. So, Kate, what changes have we seen in relation to the older generation and the workforce?
I like this question, and not just because I wrote it. You know, there's a saying, money grows where money goes. And what that really means is increasing household incomes will bolster up an area's capital growth. You know, if you've got more people with more money coming into an area, it will grow. And we talk often about areas where, you know, you go to auction and it's just a sea of silver hair and superannuation money and you've
silver
got no
hair,
chance.
That's very kind of you, silver hair. At least they got hair.
Or no hair. That's true.
And it's difficult. I can go to a single front, single level, lock and leave, beautifully renovated property with a, you know, roller door at the back. And it's a classic lock and leave in, you know, Fitzroy Village. And you know that there's going to be a lot of silver-haired bidders there, and you also know you've probably got zero chance because they're bidding out of emotion and they're looking for a solution, and it's not about value. It's about ticking a box and getting that solution. So, you know, how do we bring this back to what we're talking about today? Well, we've got to look at the segment of this generation that is doing that and what has changed, because you wouldn't have said 40 years ago that that was a force to be reckoned with and that'd be smashing all of the Gen X's out of the cool inner city areas. So what is it about the older generation and getting their hands on more money that's giving us all a run for our money and changing the landscape of inner city living? And the first thing is that we've seen them staying in the workforce for longer and earning more money. Older age limits to the pension entitlement has been something, you know, a hallmark of that as well. Enforced superannuation, one of the most incredible things that we could have done in this nation was create and enforce superannuation, because it's taken the responsibility off, you know, the social system with the old age pension, which never would have enabled someone to go and buy a single front in Fitzroy. They're working longer by choice and sometimes necessity. Kids are staying at home for longer as well. They've got, you know, a household to continue looking after. There is less welfare and they all know it. And I'm certain that there are other factors as well. There's, you know, intergenerational wealth, and there's when their parents are leaving them money. Obviously, we're about to see a new wave of that. But, Dave, what do you think?
Again, you've nailed most of the answers there, Kate.
Well, I think a really significant one, and I'll let Pete segue back into it because we talked about it before, but I think it's the most significant piece of the puzzle after superannuation, is that women are back in the workforce, and in particular, the older segment of, well, this generation that we're talking about, there has been an enormous shift in the percentage increase of older women in the workforce. So we've got lots of charts to share in our show notes here, but Pete, I'll hand the baton back to you.
And also, divorce has also created an increase in the number of older women in the workforce, and unfortunately, an increasing homeless group is mature women who are single again. And that's something that as a community we need to look at, and in particular the government should look at. And there were a number of those people on that show last night that through whatever reason they were single, whether they were single again or whether they've always been single, but, you know, financial independence was a long way off, especially if you're just solely relying on the age pension. So, again, for those young people listening in, you know, it's very important to do now or invest now so that life later on is reasonable, rather than, you know, spending all your money now and, you know, trying to live off the age pension later on, because that is not a good place to be.
Yeah.
So, Kate, sorry, Dave, you were going to say something there?
Well, yeah, I was just going to say, look, I think some of the ramifications of what Kate just described and those different factors are they increase property values at the end of the day. And, you know, it interconnects with some of last week's topic of, which I think we might touch on today as well, but how we've got lower ownership rates of property than we've ever had before in terms of owning your own home. And, you know, that interconnects with the fact that people are holding onto property for longer. So, you know, as we touched on last week, I think it's a really significant fact that we've never sold as many properties as we did in 2003. 18 years ago, despite our population obviously growing every year since then and the number of properties growing. So there is a genuine impact on, I guess, there's a social impact that government needs to try and work through because, I guess, it's oversimplifying saying the haves and have-nots. But, you know, there's certainly more people who are finding it tough to get the outcomes that probably were more achievable, you know, 20 years ago and 40 years ago, based on the pure numbers of the percentage of people who own their own home. Notwithstanding, you know, there's those various changing factors around aging population, working for longer, having kids later, getting married later, kids living at home for longer. You know, all these things do interconnect. But as a government, you've got to try and set policy settings to find the right balance.
Well, you've touched on something, Dave. You know, downsizers, well, people that want to downsize or right size and not doing anything, you know, not making a decision to sell, so we've got less properties for sale. What's contributing to that? There are a few things. And I think if we talk about right sizing, which we touched on last week, that's really finding a property that's aspirational for the next phase of your life as opposed to going into something inferior. But for a lot of people to do that, they need the security of either bridging finance or a little bit of a loan. And it might not necessarily be a 30-year loan term that they've got in mind, but they might still want to take out a loan to get the property of their dreams, and then part of their retirement plan is retiring some of that debt.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
Underemployment is something that we should touch on because there's some interesting stats here, but 6.1% of people at this age group were underemployed. That's a real issue, and I'm talking 55 and over. And underemployment, it plagues a lot of households, but it's interesting that for someone at the mature end of their career, underemployment at this level is having an impact.
Unemployment gets the headlines because it's obvious if you're unemployed, you can't borrow money to buy a house, whether it's to live in or invest.
Yeah.
But similar with underemployment, you know, it's going to be very difficult for the bank to lend you money if you're only working 2 or 3 days a week, regardless of the fact that you want to work 5 days a week. Underemployment is an issue, and we must remember that underemployment is, in simple English, is people who are working less hours than they want to. There are plenty of people that are working less that want to. Many people don't want to work 5 days and then stop and then retire and not work any days. A lot of people gradually do that, a lot of older people, but underemployment is where people want to work more, but they can't. I think the results might be skewed this year in particular because we're not getting any overseas people that can take those jobs. So it's really only those of us that were here basically in March 2020 that can take up any new jobs. So I think we'll see unemployment numbers and underemployment numbers drop significantly this year. But when the borders open and our overseas migrants come back in, then we'll see it go back to some sort of normality. But yeah, it's very interesting. Underemployment is not just associated with the young people. It's also older people. Some older people will say that it's ageism, which is like discrimination because they're older. I don't know if that's a thing, but some people's perception is that. It's certainly an issue for the older age group. Dave, you were talking about home ownership before and how the rate of home ownership has dropped. Do we have any reasons for why that's happening? Is it just because, or is it even because houses are too expensive, or is it something else?
Ooh.
Look, I think potentially they are, but coming back to some of what you're just talking about, Pete, and what Kate was talking about, the percentage of the families who have two people working driving up borrowing capacity and affordability, where historically, even that when there was couples, and the great positive thing of having more women in the workforce means we've got more numbers of two people working. I think so proportionally, if you're a single, and then if you're underemployed single, it is harder than it's probably ever been to own a home. And that's probably the big change over the last 20, 30, 40 years, that if you're single, it's much harder to own a home because a much higher percentage of couples both earn an income to increase the affordability and therefore price points.
That's a really interesting point, Dave, and I'll always challenge it.
I'll challenge that too, but we don't have time for this podcast.
That's another podcast. But, you know, just a quick one, you know, low interest rates and high LVRs and incentives.
Hang on, do you challenge that that more couples have two people working? Because that's my main point there.
No, not at all.
I don't challenge that.
On that basis, anyone that says, oh, property prices should just double every 10 years or double every 7 years, that's out the window because the rate of additions to the collective workforce in a family unit can't be really increased unless we change our nuclear family makeup, which would be an enormous social change for Australia.
So my primary point there is that it's harder for singles than it's probably ever been.
Yeah, very cool.
I agree with that. Okay. We agree.
So back to why people aren't buying homes, you know, that you've touched on one reason, Dave. I think, you know, socially it's not as big a deal. It's not the key aspiration like it used to be. And, you know, more people are educated and for longer, more are travelling. You know, there's so many young people, if you talk to them, and I know I'm sounding old saying that, but, you know, chat to a Gen Y or a millennial, they're not thinking, let's just, you know, nail this house and get some debt and do that when we're 22. They're thinking, let's finish the course and then take off for a while. We've got more new arrivals as well. So while they're skilled migrants, they're not necessarily cashed up and ready to go with procuring a home. And the employment risk, you know, we talked about underemployment, casualisation of the workforce, the gig economy. There's not a lot of job security in these types of roles. And unfortunately, it's really plagued the younger generations and they haven't had that loyalty and that guarantee of income that the older generations have. And I do feel for them in that regard because you'd need to take on $1 million worth of debt to buy a house in a capital city, and that's a big ask if someone's not certain whether they're going to have a job next week.
Can I mention something here, Kate, about the younger ones in particular? So when I used to teach undergraduate students, they were all about, and we're talking like 19, 20, 21-year-olds, they were all about renting where the action was, which is basically close to the city.
Yep.
Now that I look after a master's program and we're talking about 25-year-olds plus, now they're talking about saving some money to buy a house. But the big difference here is, like at 25, they're thinking that. But at 24, I think me and my generation, we'd either already bought our first home or we had a serious deposit. And when I say serious, back then you needed a 25% deposit, not a 5% deposit like today. So it certainly is changing amongst the young ones, but it looks like once maybe they've rented for a while, then they start and they're in full-time work, then some of them, not all of them, some of them start to think, yes, maybe I do need to buy. So for me, it's been an interesting difference there between the really young ones, those that, you know, have just started uni or just left high school, to the ones that are a little bit more mature in their mid to late 20s. They have a different mindset.
So let's say the percentage of ownership is pushed back on average. You know, when it was, you're 25 to 34.
Well, we can see it. We've got a really good chart. The home ownership chart shows that at various intervals, 25-year-olds have taken on, over the years, have taken on.
Here we go. So 25 to 29 was about 40% in 1991.
Yep.
And then 2016, it's down at about 30%. Now, what I'd like to see is a crossover between how we've pushed back as the percentage has dropped for home ownership as to how many years we've pushed back to starting a family. And I wonder if
there's a correlation.
Yeah.
Yeah, really good idea. There's a lot of stuff that we could delve into there. That's probably another episode. That's great.
I think it is. Yeah, certainly a lot of things are happening later. You know, people buying a house later, people getting together later, people having kids later. A lot of things are certainly changing so far as the social context is concerned.
And that was what you were disagreeing with me on before, which I understand that it's gotten harder. It hasn't necessarily gotten harder. And so I just want to connect to that as well. but John, I do think it's harder for singles. But yeah, that would be really interesting, wouldn't it, to see that correlation? Because in essence, people are making life choices to put things off, to do the things Kate was just explaining. But it does come with, you know, often choosing to, and you've just given the examples through uni, Pete, to decide to own property later. Now, that's going to impact property ownership rates and ultimately your financial outcome at the end of your life.
Yeah, and one thing I want to emphasise here just before we go into the next point, Kate mentioned more of us are educated. So what does that mean? That means instead of leaving high school at year 10, and many of the people that I went to high school left at year 10 to get an apprenticeship, all right? Now, even if you're going to get an apprenticeship, you're going to go through year 12, but many more people are now going to uni rather than going to work after year 12. So you delay that opportunity to earn money, then of course you're going to delay that opportunity to save the money for the deposit to buy the house. So there's a lot of things happening socially which is having a big impact on property. Who owns it, when they're going to own it, and what they're going to do with it as they get older. So we have focused a bit on the older people here. So, Kate, why do older people consume less?
Well, yeah, it is a good question, and there's been a little bit of a social change in that pattern more recently. But in short, less transport, so whether that's, you know, holidays or getting around town, public transport or owning their own car, so the car is a major part of it, and also less eating out. And they're not likely supporting children any longer. So once they get to this age bracket, their household is usually one or two people. And there is definitely a fear about limited savings for retirement. You know, we've still got a generation that were very close to their parents and that generation, the wartime generation, where, you know, that they would be scrimping and saving, the Depression era. And I don't think they've forgotten their parents' patterns. So they're always concerned about their superannuation balance and what the future of their retirement looks like and the health options. So, yeah, I think fear certainly plays a part in that, Pete.
Yeah, look, for some of our listeners who are getting to that age, or for everyone listening, because hopefully we're all going to get to that age, if I can give you my personal experience, we've just started speaking with a financial planner now because I turned 60 and so I'm closer to retirement than not. And, you know, in very simple English, this is what we've worked out. Our superannuation is going to cater for the necessities in life, and the property investments are going to cater for the niceties in life. So we've got a steady income from super, so we're going to, you know, draw a certain amount every year. But, you know, for those overseas trips or whatever we want to do, that comes out of another bucket of money. And I think for people who are worried about retirement, if you can, you know, with any big task, if you can break it down into smaller tasks, it makes it more achievable. So, look, the reality is most of us work. So we're going to get, and we are PAYG income earners. So we're going to have super, right? So really, property investment is a way to supplement our super. You just need to work out how much of a supplement would you like by the time you turn 55, 60, or if you go, you know, with the FIRE movement, maybe you want to, you know, retire earlier. But I think it's very important to sort that out in the early days, because buying and selling property is very expensive. You don't want to buy a property and think, oh, geez, I made a mistake, I should change it and buy something else. It's not like the share market, you know, where transactions are pretty cheap. Yeah. So you want to get some good advice, buy the right property, so get yourself a good buyer's agent, speak to a strategic mortgage broker to get the right mortgage to save yourself money so you're paying the least amount of money in interest and you have other advantages to set yourself up for the future.
And develop a property plan.
Correct. Develop the property plan. Okay, so coming near the end of our podcast, what could this mean for our economic outlook as our aged population numbers increase?
Yeah, so it is a difficult one. We've got a bit of a conundrum because not every ageing population member is necessarily buying property in Fitzroy North. We've talked a little bit about the impact of a divorce, and we've talked also about underemployment. And we do have a large collective moving through who will need social support. And I personally think that we'll see a change in attitude towards regular mum and dad investors providing housing. And I think the provision of housing is going to become a burning issue in our nation, particularly knowing that we've already got a really tight rental market and exorbitant rentals in some areas in terms of the increases that they've been sustaining. Dave, what do you think?
Yeah, well, look, with the ageing population, we're going to have to fund more aged homes. We know the problems in that space. There's been a Royal Commission into it. And if less of the population are working, there's less money to fund these things. So, you know, this is going to become a greater challenge as the percentage of our population become older. And we know that from some of the numbers we covered last week that about 8 out of 10 don't choose to actually right-size their stayers. And what actually precipitates them moving is they have to, through health deterioration or an accident or something. So there's no simple solutions, but it's certainly something that will have an impact. Look, if we can create something that stimulates the baby boomers to make decisions so we don't have 8 out of 10 stayers, which frees up residential property supply, I think that can be positive overall in terms of more home ownership rates and less pressure on also, you know, rents. Now, that's talking down growth rates in property and the return on property as an investment if they can achieve that. But, you know, that's part of the picture.
Yeah, I've got some quirky stats that really caught my eye because, you know, there is a bit of a divide with the older generation. First and foremost, I talked about more women in the workforce, and there's an interesting stat that I found that talks about this generation. And back in 1999, which is not all that long ago, we had 30% of 55 to 64-year-old women in the workforce. Now, wind the clock forward 21 years to 2020, that figure's doubled. 60% are in the workforce. And that has significant bearing on all kinds of things, including property and property selection. We have to assume that there'll be a portion of that contingent that are earning really strong incomes, and they might be living on their own, or they could be in a couple's relationship, and they will most likely be, you know, reflected in the auction numbers of people putting up their hands for properties that are closer to town. So we are seeing certainly an increase in cashed up baby boomers. And if we go to another stat that really surprised me, it was just talking about the split of debt. And households aged above 54 have a relatively even split of owner-occ debt and other property debt. And the main increase in investment property ownership over the past two decades has been in the 50-plus age group. And I really scratched my head at that because we see a lot of young people talking about property investing, and I chat to a lot of, you know, Gen Ys, Gen Xs, but the reality is the majority of investors are older investors.
It's a really interesting stat, and it doesn't surprise me. You know, you're getting to the stage where you're in a stronger financial position. You know, maybe your kids have moved out or they're getting close to you, and you finally get to that point for many people where they're able to invest in an investment property or two. 90%, as Pete shared, only own one or two properties, and it probably makes sense, doesn't it? I think it's a good reminder too for our listeners, you know, like you don't have to do everything straight away. You don't have to do it fast. You know, property is a get-rich-slow scheme, and you don't need to own lots to really supplement your superannuation.
And that's a good way to finish, because I was just going to mention, even if you own freehold one average price property, which in Australia is about $650,000, interestingly, that's what a couple needs to retire on, $650,000. You go to most financial planners and they'll pull out that stat. So even if you had one property, plus obviously the super that you're getting anyway, you know, you're in a very good position. Even if you just worked on buying the one property and just paying it off, you know, you're going to set yourself up very well for retirement rather than relying on the old age pension. Look, thank you very much, Kate, and thank you very much, Dave. Very interesting topic. But please don't go away, listeners, as we've got our gold nuggets.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
It's all about the power of time. We've talked about what happens when you get to, you know, your golden years, but you touched on it, Pete, about just needing one good property. Now, if you can get onto the property ladder relatively young and just work on retiring that debt, you'll be very surprised just how far it can advance your financial position. I think property is such a forgiving asset class when you make a half-decent decision, or hopefully a really good decision, and just hold firm and pay it down.
Excellent. Dave, what's your gold nugget?
Look, I might just support Kate's and just encourage our younger listeners to buck the trend and get into property earlier like previous generations have, and manage your money well, which is, you know, a primary part of the FIRE movement. And you build up that differential, particularly before you have children. You can put yourself well ahead of the game in proportion to most of the population, and that'll set you up to be in that smaller percentage of the population who own one or two or maybe even more investment properties when they actually retire.
Excellent. Some excellent gold nuggets there from both Dave and Kate that appeal to our younger listeners and some of our older listeners. So once again, thank you for taking the time to listen in to the Property Planner Byron Professor, and we look forward to having your company again next week. Bye for now.
See you later.
See you next week.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about planning for your future, take a listen to episode number 4, How to Develop Your Own Property Plan, Start with the End in Mind. Episode number 5, The Lifestyle versus Investment Conundrum. Episode number 18, How Age and Stage of Life Can Impact Your Property Plan and Selection. Episode 22, Why the Family Home is Often the Biggest Piece of the Investment Puzzle. And finally, episode 27, How many properties do you need to retire wealthy?
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super products.
And the property buyer, Kate Bakos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year, and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia, and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast, and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist, and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.